Hi, everybody. Hi. Hi. Today, I'm going to talk about an inspirational Soto Zen, contemporary Soto Zen teacher, Blanche Hartman, who died on May 13th, just a few days after her 90th birthday. You might remember seeing her picture up here. It was up on the altar for the traditional 49 days. With a plaque in her memory. Her Dharma name was Zenkai, which means inconceivable joy. How about that for a Dharma name? Inconceivable joy. Imagine walking up to somebody and saying, "Hi, inconceivable joy." It's great. Let me read a couple of sentences from her obituary. She was one of the first women to lead a Zen training temple outside of Asia. Her Zen teaching focused on simplicity, curiosity, patience, love, and compassion. And she sought to make the Zen community open and accessible to everyone. So I want to read that again. Simplicity, curiosity, patience, love, and compassion. And making the Zen community open and accessible. She grew up in Alabama during the Depression, and her parents both taught at the university there. Both of her parents lost their jobs because the family was very involved in political and civil rights movement, and so both of her parents lost their job, and her father became a civil rights labor organizer and civil rights activist after that. And Blanche maintained her commitment to social activism for the rest of her life. Come on in, there's a bunch of seats over there. When she was in the first grade, her public school closed. This was in Alabama during the Depression. I have a hard time getting my head wrapped around that. The public school closed because of lack of funds. And so her parents put her in the local Catholic elementary school, even though the family was Jewish. And her second grade teacher, Sister Mary Catherine Flynn, was this huge inspiration to her. Blanche was really taken by Sister Mary Catherine's quality of devotion. And that quality was reflected in Blanche's life as a Zen teacher and as a priest, you know, 50, 60, 80 years later in her life. It just made this huge impression on her. So I'm going to talk more about devotion a little bit later. The family eventually moved to California, and during World War II, Blanche worked as an airplane mechanic for the Army and loved it. So she was a Rosie the Riveter during World War II. And after the war, she married Lou Hartman, and they had four kids. And like her family, when she was growing up, she and Lou were really involved in social justice issues. And Lou lost his job because of it. He had been a popular radio personality in San Francisco, and he was blacklisted by the House Un-American Activities Committee, and wasn't cleared for years. It took a long time. So when he lost his job and his family, and so Blanche went back to school and completed her degree in the application of statistical methods to chemistry and biochemistry. It was one of those put your own major together, and that's pretty much what I would have majored in if I had had that kind of choice. And she supported her family as a biostatistician for the state of California. She started out working for a private company, but she found out that the men were paid more than the women, and so she quit and went to work for the state, where that wasn't the case. In an interview last year, she talked about an incident that happened in 1968. They were living in Berkeley at this time. She said, "I was just living my life and paying attention to the things that interested me. And I heard myself at one point saying, 'I'm fighting for peace.' And I thought, that's kind of an oxymoron, isn't it? Isn't there a peaceful way to work for peace? I began to look at my very firmly held opinions that led to saying things like fighting for peace. And that led me to various peace demonstrations." So at that point, there had been a number of altercations between the students and the police during these demonstrations. And then she said, "A community leader went on TV and urged ordinary folks to come out to the campus to interpose themselves between the police and the students to prevent further violence." I love this part. "So I got dressed up in my blue cashmere suit and hat and gloves just to make it clear I was one of the ordinary folks and not one of the students, and went out to the campus. I was standing around watching things happen, and we heard the announcement from a bullhorn, 'This is an illegal assembly.' And a phalanx of riot squad policemen came around the corner of the building to start clearing people out of the gathering place." And then comes the moment that changed her life. She says, "Without thinking, I ducked under the hands of the people in front of me, and there I was, face to face with a riot squad policeman, full riot gear. We made eye contact, and I had a visceral experience of being identical to this policeman. I had never heard of 'we're all one with anything,' or anything like the things we've all heard of now. But the experience was extremely real, and I felt a great need to find somebody who could explain to me how I could be identical with the riot squad policeman. Not whether it happened, that was the experience, and I had no way of understanding it." So she started talking with people about it and asking people about it, and someone suggested that she go to Berkeley Zen Center because they talked about things like that there. And she met Mel Weitzman, who was the head teacher there, and then later she met his teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi from San Francisco Zen Center, and his assistant, Dainen Katagiri Roshi, who later came here and founded this place. And she was very taken by them. So she started attending morning meditation every morning. She started going to retreats. She started doing doksan, individual meetings with the teachers. And she spent the rest of her life devoted to Zen practice. So the whole second half of her life was devoted to Zen practice. She was ordained 11 years later, and she received Dharma transmission, permission to teach independently, 11 years after that. And in 1996, she became the first abbess of San Francisco Zen Center. And she used the title abbess purposely. She was an ardent feminist, and the title abbess might seem like not the obvious choice. But... but at that point, that was a very unusual thing, and she wanted her title to make it clear that a woman was leading this Zen Center. Since that time, there have been, I think, probably more women than men as guiding teachers there. But at the time, it was really unusual. And once their kids were grown, she and Lou lived in the three practice places of San Francisco Zen Center for the rest of their lives, between the city center that was right in town, Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, which is about 4 hours south of there in the mountains, in the wilderness, and Green Gulch Farm, which is just north of Golden Gate Bridge a little ways in Marin County. So they lived at those places, and she led practice periods. She gave probably hundreds of Dharma talks. And she was an ardent, devoted teacher of sewing. Last year, she had a book published. This one, Seeds for a Boundless Life, Zen Teachings from the Heart. And this is our library copy. It's a wonderful book. It's excerpts from her talks that she had given, edited excerpts from her talks. And the thing I was struck by when I read this book was how down-to-earth her teachings are. You know, she's concerned with how are we living our lives right here, right now? You know, what does Zazen have to do with the way that I conduct myself? What do these teachings mean in the context of our 20th, 21st century lives? It was very here and now kind of teaching. One example of that is on the front page of the bulletin. She said, if we're open to embracing the surprises as they arise, then there will be inconceivable joy. If we fuss and fume and say, this isn't what I expected, then there will be inconceivable misery. Just to welcome your life as it arrives moment by moment, to meet it as fully as you can, being as open to it as you can, being as ready for whatever arises as you can, and meeting it wholeheartedly, this is renunciation. This is leaving behind all of your preferences, all your ideas and notions and schemes, just meeting life as it is. So, Four Noble Truths right there in plain English. So she became a sewing teacher. I want to talk a little bit about sewing. In our tradition, sewing plays an important part in a couple of... it plays an important part. When you become a priest, you sew your own robe. And, you know, it's a big, giant robe. And you sew it. And when you go through a ceremony called Zen Initiation, or Jukai, you sew a small version of it called the Roksu, which looks like this. And it's... With the Roksu, we take a piece of material that's about 48 inches by 15 inches, and we cut it up into little small pieces, and we do this incredible origami with it, where we fold it into pieces, sew it back together, and it becomes a version of Buddha's robe. It's a practice of Zazen. It's a practice where with each stitch when we're sewing, we say Namuki Butsu, or I take refuge in Buddha. So it's sewing, but it's also a way of... When people ask me about what I do here at Zen Center, and I used to tell them I'm a sewing teacher, but I learned not to say that because people think home ec, and the conversation is over and they're scooching away from you. But now I tell them, I've learned to say instead, what I do is teach people what Zazen on the cushion has to do with the rest of your life. Because doing this practice and paying attention and watching all the things that come up in your mind as you're doing it is the same as what happens with Zazen. So Zazen is the same as sewing, and sewing is the same as your life. And it's a very... See, I don't even know how to talk about it. I just know how to do it. So anyway, she became a sewing teacher, whatever that means. The tradition of sewing started in this country in the early 70s when two sewing teachers came over from Japan and taught two people here how to teach it. One of the people was Blanche and the other one was Tomoe Katagiri, who later moved here with her husband and became our sewing teacher. So Blanche and Tomoe, between the two of them, on different parts of the continent, taught all of the subsequent sewing teachers, and then they've been teaching people. And so 45 years later, there are sewing teachers available pretty much for every sangha in the country in one way or another. And it's all because of those two teachers. They were both, actually, but Blanche was an unlikely candidate to be a sewing teacher. You know, airplane mechanic, right? Biochemist, ardent feminist. But she was asked by the abbot, Richard Baker, when the sewing teacher came over from Japan, he asked, they knew that they only had her for a short period of time, so he asked Blanche if she would learn how to sew from this Japanese nun named Joshin. And Blanche agreed and learned how to sew at Tassajara by the light of kerosene lanterns. And Joshin didn't speak any English, and Blanche didn't speak any Japanese. So what they did was Joshin would fold a piece of fabric and then hand it to Blanche, and then Blanche would fold it. And then Joshin would do it again, and Blanche would do it again until she learned how to do it. And those of you who have sewn okesas or roxus can appreciate that that was a very difficult thing to do. That was a very difficult thing to do. Tomoe told me when she first started teaching sewing in San Francisco, her English wasn't what it is today. And the only thing that she knew how to say to people was, that's okay, or please do over. So because of these two nuns in her life, Sister Mary Catherine Flynn, her second grade teacher, and Joshin-san, the nun who came over from Japan, she developed a very devotional practice. You could see it in her sewing, and if you read her book, you'll see it there too. She had a connection to Minnesota Zen Center. She had known Katagiri when he was in San Francisco Zen Center. And she and Lou came here sometime in the late 70s or early 80s for a session down at Hokyoji, the country temple that MCMC founded. And they went to a session there with Katagiri. And then she came back in, I think it was about 1998, for Karen Suna's mountain seat ceremony. Karen Suna was the first of Katagiri's Dharma heirs to become a guiding teacher here. And she gave this wonderful talk. That was the first time that I met Blanche. And all I knew was that she was this important woman from San Francisco Zen Center, and heard her give this great talk. I didn't meet her personally until I went to a session at San Francisco Zen Center in about 2005. Shohaku Okamura was giving a Genzoe session, so it's a teaching session. It was a week long, and he was speaking about Dogen's fascicle on the robe. And so there were a lot of sewing teachers going to it, and my girlfriend and I went. And I'd been ordained for about a year and a half at that point, so I wasn't a complete bumbling idiot, but I was still pretty self-conscious. And I had the opportunity to go to Doksan with Blanche. Doksan is a private meeting with the teacher during session. And I wasn't going to do it because I was intimidated. That was a me thing, not a her thing. I was too intimidated. But my girlfriend said, no, she's great. You have to go. You know, you really have to do it. And so I did. And the custom there is that you sit outside the door, and when the teacher's ready for you, they ring a bell, and you open the door and walk in, and the teacher's seated there. You do three prostrations to them, three standing with the three full bows, and then you sit down and you talk about whatever you want to talk about. So the bell rang, and I walked in, and she was standing up. And we kind of looked at each other, and she said, oh, I guess I rang too soon. And I thought, okay, she's not scary, she's kind of real. And she said, well, tell you what, you stand there and I'll sit down and then we'll pretend like this never happened. And so she did, she got seated, and then I did my bows, and then I sat down and I organized my robe, and She leaned over and she looked at my robe and she said, "What beautiful stitches." And I went, "I like this lady." I like her. So she was very real and she was very kind. But she was also not going to waste our time in there. You know, she's very kind of no-nonsense. What do you want to talk about? What are we talking about? And there was no sort of chit-chat there. We just did it. At one point during that week, Shuhaku was giving one of his talks, and almost as an aside, he mentioned that Blanche was the leading authority on sewing in this country. And when he said that, I did this little... because my teacher Tomoy was the other, and he hadn't mentioned her, and but Blanche immediately stood up and said, "No, there's also Tomoy Katagiri." And when she said that, she just struck me as somebody who had the self confidence to understand sort of her place in the pantheon, but she also had the she was also quick to share the credit with Tomoy. So I was very impressed by her that first time. And I saw her one other time after that, and then the last time that I saw her was in 2013 at the first gathering of sewing teachers that was held at Green Gulch Farm, San Francisco Zen Center's temple, just north of the city. She was 87 years old then, and she was fragile. She had aged a lot since I had seen her before. And I remember seeing the car drive up, and the woman who was the current abbess and another one of the sort of senior teachers, they each took Blanche, you know, under each elbow and helped her walk very slowly into the conference center that we were meeting in, and brought her cane. And I remember thinking, you know, these people are taking really good care of her. It was really heartwarming. You could really see that people really loved her. You could see that, you know, 40 or 50 years of living at the place and practicing with these people, you could see how that manifested in the way that they treasured her presence. They were taking good care of her. So it was a full day. And she got tired, but she hung in there and she participated pretty well in the discussion. She showed us a sewing technique, I remember at one point. And at one point someone else was showing us how to a different way to put the case together. And everybody crowded around her, and Blanche was right there in front, you know, looking at it and asking her questions and just really still very interested and engaged in learning something new about sewing after all those years. I sat across from her at lunch, and when she sat down, she asked me who I was and where I was from, and then she apologized because she hadn't remembered my name from the introductions that morning. I thought, it's okay. But then she said, "As I get older, I find that my cognitive functions aren't what they used to be." Where anybody else would have said, "I'm getting forgetful." You know, my cognitive functions aren't what they used to be. She had this great dignity about her. But the thing about that day that I remember best was at one point she told everybody, she said that our sewing students need to know that our love for them isn't contingent on our ability to create parallel and perpendicular lines. And I was just, I was sort of thunderstruck when she said that, because nobody had ever talked about love in the context of our relationship with other people in Zen before. I'd never heard anybody talk about loving other people in that kind of Zen context. So it was a revelation to me. You know, before that, I had thought of sewing as something that I helped other people with and tried to help them see that, you know, it was more than just stitching up this little garment. And that one sentence broadened, it completely opened up what my idea of sewing meant. You know, I thought about that statement a lot when I got home. I still think about it a lot. And I realized that with every group of people who come through sewing Rock Sews and the Okesa sewers, by the end of the 3 months that it takes us to sew a Rock Sew, I find that I love every single person I've been sewing with. And it feels a little sort of exposed to say something like that in front of everybody. It feels a little bit raw to say in front of everybody that I loved all the sewing students. But here's another excerpt from her book. She said, "I practice with many beautiful people who are interested in the Dharma and concerned with how they live their lives. And I'm falling in love all the time because of how they practice Buddha's teachings. It's hard not to love people who are loving themselves. It's hard not to love people who are in pain and need help and support, or who help me when I am in pain and I need help and support." I think it's commonly sort of acknowledged that as she grew older, she started talking more about things like love and compassion. And I think that was because of her devotion to her teacher, even many, many years after Joshin-san died. You could still see the devotion that she had to her teacher and to her devotion to practice and sewing practice, and also the long stretches of time that she spent working very closely with people in the sewing room and with a lot of sewing students. There was a second gathering early last month of sewing teachers, and it had been scheduled for almost a year for 5 days at Tassajara, 4 hours south of San Francisco. And by one of those fortuitous circumstances, the day that it was supposed to start turned out to be the day that was scheduled for Blanche's funeral. And so instead of driving down to Tassajara early that morning, we stayed in town so that the sewing teachers could go to her funeral. And the Buddha hall there was jammed with people. The seats were just packed in there. And they had another room. They had the cafeteria set up with a big screen TV so the overflow crowd could sit in there. And I thought, you know, I'm from somewhere far away. I only met her a couple of times. I'm going to go sit in the cafeteria. But they said they wanted all the sewing teachers in the Buddha hall. And they set aside 2 rows of seats for the sewing teachers to represent the importance of this practice in her life. So we all sat in there together. And if you would like to see a high Zen funeral, as it's done in this country, you can watch the video on the San Francisco Zen Center website, sfcc.org. It was quite something. It started out with a procession, people carrying things into the altar. And one of the people was carrying Blanche's favorite pincushion. So there were formal presentations and offerings, and there were drums and cymbals going, and there was chanting, and it was the most formal Zen ceremony I've ever been to. But it was also really, it was very warm and lovey because a number of people spoke. Her granddaughter spoke, a number of people from her family spoke, Sangha members spoke, and they all talked about kind of the different aspects of her life and the different ways that they knew her. One of the sewing teachers spoke, and at one point her son led the assembly in singing her favorite song, which was many, many verses of This Little Light of Mine. You know that song, This Little Light of Mine, I'm going to let it shine from the highest mountain. And we sang many, many verses of this song. It was wonderful. And from what I heard, a day or so before she died, she had been singing that song from her bed. So it was actually a great big light, and she certainly did let it shine. So huge inspiration to me, huge inspiration to a lot of people. And this month's Buddha Dharma magazine, if you read Buddha Dharma magazine, there's an article about her and a big, beautiful picture of her and a small picture of her hands sewing. You can take a look at it later if you'd like. So, there's a copy in the library. That's right. Thank you. So, Blanche Hartman. I think that's everything I want to say. I had to say about that. Is there anyone have any questions or comments or songs or they sing more out there than we do. I one of their teachers came here one time to Clouds and Water, and he seemed to me to be very sort of, you know, very Zen teacher like. And somebody said, "Will you sing us a song?" And so he started singing, "Red, Red Robin Goes Bob, Bob, Bobbing Along," which is also a very Zen song. Yes?
I'm just sitting here. I just amazed. I had no idea that sewing had anything to do with any of this. The first I've ever heard of that.
Yeah.
And sewing is really important to me. I just do it regularly.
Mm.
And I work with third graders, and we have this special once-a-week thing where we do this, what they call an enrichment. And I did sewing this year.
Did you?
And you're talking about love. I mean, it's just so amazing to see what these third graders, we did two sessions of it because they had so much fun with it. And it's hard not to love those kids when, you know, they're struggling with that thread and the needle, and everyone is so focused and calm, and conversations are very different when you're in that place.
They are.
And so this was just really fun.
It is a wonderful practice. And people are very scared about it, you know. Every time before we have a sewing class, somebody will come up to me and say, you know, I want to do that, but I've never sewn anything in my life. And I have to reassure them it has really not that much to do with sewing. Once you learn the stitch itself, Matt's laughing. It has much more to do with watching your state of mind. You know, people have done it who have never sewn never threaded a needle in their life. Guys with great big football hands. You know, done it. So, yeah.
I don't know if I can speak for all of your students, but I'm sure most of us feel the love that you have for them.
Oh, thank you.
Reciprocated.
Oh, that's a great thing about being a sewing teacher. One of the other sewing teachers said last year, how did this go? All of our students are beloved. That's the secret that we sewing teachers share. Yeah, just very lovely thing. Yeah.
Are there ways
students participate in Zen sewing beyond sewing of the rakusu?
Oh. Yes, you can help me cut out the fabric beforehand. Oh.
The Orioki napkins,
yes, we sew Orioki napkins and Orioki utensil holders and things. So yes, there is, actually.
I just remember when I was sewing mine, the lesson I learned was, I remember between the stitches, I had something different I said. It wasn't exactly a Zen thing.
Yeah.
But it was sort of terrifying at the beginning because I had never sewed. And then what I learned was, and working with Tomoe, was I wanted to do it my own way. And there was no way, there was only really one way to do it.
There's
and
one true way.
Constantly ripping on seams and her smiling and saying no. At one point she said, we were all standing around in bureaucracy with a bunch of different teachers, and they said, well, what do you think you should do? And she smiled and said, give up? I got the message.
Oh. You know, we've never lost a sewing student. We've had people who, you know, because they couldn't do it. She had one person, she told me one time, Tomoe, that somebody was sewing and they decided they just couldn't, and so they said they were going to stop. And so she said okay, and she took their scraps that they hadn't finished, you know, and they came back to her, you know, years later and said, I've decided, you know, I'm up for this, I can do it. And she said great, and she went and got his scraps and gave them to him. So I have some downstairs too. I'm not naming names, but you're welcome to finish it anytime.
Question.
Yeah.
I took some African drumming class, and I remember how glorious it was.
Yeah.
The funnel energy
through
the whole body.
Yeah.
And then when we had to use the sticks, I found it really painful to like focus the energy through the stick. And I remember one girl was really good at the sticks, but for the life of her, she couldn't sort of bang a drum.
Yeah.
But she was also really, really good at sewing. She could really send energy through this tiny little sliver of a piece of metal.
Mm.
And the thought of it to me is excruciating. Mm. Like just the thought of like holding. I remember as a little child trying to put the houses on Monopoly and feeling how hard it was to like get the energy to like hold a small object and move it.
Yeah.
And so I guess I'm wondering, are, you know, a student that just doesn't excel at this kind of meticulous focus, it isn't necessarily the only way to meticulously focus. So I guess the question has to do with judgment, maybe. I don't know what it has to do with. Mm-hmm. But do you have to be a sewer to, like, make a raksu and be a Zen master?
You have to be a sewer to be a Zen master. I want to make that clear.
You do?
No. No. No, you don't have... It really... Well, I'll tell you. Sewing raksu is part of Zen initiation, which means that you are agreeing to live your life according to the Buddha way. So it's part of this great, big, small, personal decision that you make. And people make their raksus, and then they give them to their teacher, and their teacher writes on the back of them and then gives them back to them. Usually they write on the back of them.
Here, I am on.
There you go. Yeah. And the most unlikely people, you know, the sewing part is, it's a challenge for a lot of people, but you find out that it really doesn't matter if you're a good sower or you don't have any facility, you know, facility for it. Sometimes it's better not to be a really good sower. Sometimes people come in and they've been sowing their entire lives, and so they know how to sow. And so they have to learn how to do something that they know really well in a completely different way. And sometimes for them it's a lot harder. We had a woman in one of our classes who was a very good sower, and at one point her Roxu was just in terrible trouble. And you know, we're sowing in silence, so the room is really quiet. And Tomoy's talking to her about it, and Tomoy looks up at her and says, have you sown before? Are you a good sower? And she said, why, yes, I am. And Tomoy goes, oh, that's the problem. And it was true. Yeah. So.
This has something to do with having a prescribed pattern. For instance, if you were to buy a piece of cloth that had an embroidery pattern on it, mm-hmm. and you sat and embroidered it with the same intention, would it generate, do you think, the same sense of awareness? It seems to me it's about what happens to you when you're actually doing it that seems to be the crux of the whole matter, and that it's very intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of frustration and inflation, all sorts of things come up in part of the awareness and process.
Yeah, it's all the things that are coming up in your mind. You know, sometimes you're very frustrated, and other times you're sort of sitting on the golden Buddha seat when you're doing it, and you're very, you know, yeah.
But
yeah, but in either case, all it is what's going on in your mind. You know, it's kind of the same thing, whether you're frustrated or whether you're sort of thrilled at yourself for doing this, or whether you're in the zone. I mean, in all cases, it's just like zazen. It's just another thing that's going through your mind. Sewing is the same sort of as doing as eating at a sesshin. We eat with orioki bowls, and it's a meditation, and it's a ritual. And when you eat using that ritual, it's a whole different experience than when you're eating at home. Because you're devoting this intention to it, and you're doing it in this particular way, and you're letting go of all your thoughts and ideas about it, and you're just doing it in this particular way.
Extending yourself outward, some offering of your spirit or your activity or whatever to the Buddha way.
Yeah.
And if you do things in an everyday way, it's more self-centered. More the energy isn't going outward. It's more like you're trying to bring things into yourself, like this is what I need to do right now, this is what I want to do, but it's not offering it out.
Yeah.
So I just feel like devotion is a really critical aspect of Buddhism.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you. And it's true. You know, it's devotion. It is offering it out, and it's with sewing. It doesn't have to do with you. It has to do with you're sharing this with people, but you're not really teaching it to people. And there's a very devotional aspect to it. And And I feel the same way about Tomoe as my sewing teacher. She did about Joshin. You know, you have this incredible devotion to your teacher. I think probably tea ceremony is the same way.
I just want to say thank you for introducing Blanche to me, because I hadn't heard of her, and I just find the quote that you chose really amazing, because I've had the experience of both embracing surprises as they arise, and also being stuck in misery and saying, this isn't what I expected.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm excited to read that book, and I like Zen when it's very applicable, you know, to my life. And this just seems very applicable to my life and every single day.
Yeah, me too. I want to be able to say, what does this have to do with my life today?
Yeah.
What does this have to do with going on, with what's going on right now? And anyway. Yeah.
Ben. I'd like to expand a little bit on what Andrea said about devotion.
Yeah.
I noticed the same thing. If there's a devotional aspect of it. And the sewing to me came easy, and you wondered why, and I said, it's just another hobby. And I realized.
I remember when you said that.
I'm disappointed at that. But I realized that I apply some devotion to all of my hobbies in the same way, where I just put my full concentration into it. And I love getting out of that flow state and just concentrating, and that's all I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I apply the same thing to my sewing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems to me to be tapping into a really strong creative soul.
Mm-hmm. Creative, and yet you do it this way.
Yeah.
This way. When I sewed my Raksu in 1997, and I didn't really understand. And I was thinking, well, maybe I'd like to do a purple one. And then they gave us this material, and I went, wait a minute. And that was just the beginning of the things that I wasn't able to decide on.
I want to make a red one for my diesel.
Yeah, well.
That's the way it's done.
I know, diesel in red, yeah. So, okay, thank you.